Part 5, Chapter 14, The Trekker's Summit. The team left Lobachet early, taking only a couple of hours to reach Gorg Shep, the last village before Everest Base Camp. The Trekkers were really excited today. They would finally get their summit. For many Trekkers to Everest Base Camp, Kalapatar is their summit. It's almost an inconsequential hill in the context of the greater Himalaya, but it offers a fantastic view of Everest, especially at dawn or at sunset. It is 18,209 feet and provides an unobstructed view of Everest. Perhaps it's the best from Nepal site. How hard will it be? Trekker asked Dawa. Well, we'll go slowly, slowly. Bastari, Bastari, he replied, lowering his hands palm down. One of the Trekkers smiled at his fellow teammates as they left the lodge Gorg Shep. They could see a big hill, but not any sign of an actual summit. They would need to gain 1,267 feet from the lodge to the summit. The climbers, Trekkers, John Paul, and Dawa crossed a frozen lake and began the gradual hike up a barren hillside. They passed by a young man holding the reins of a horse. He was ready to sell rice to the top for a reasonable 350 rupees. They were expecting about a four-hour round trip. Half an hour into the hike, Jim spoke up, out of breath. Must be the altitude. Look, Dutch said, pointing to his right, Everest. They could just see the top of their ultimate objective peeking over the west shoulder. Even though they saw Everest from Namche Hill, the Everest View Hotel, and on the trek leaving Namche, knowing that base camp was just 2 miles away and that they would be soon in the icefall, made everything different now. Suddenly, the calm day turned windy. It was cold. Glad we packed extra jackets, Harper said. Well, it is the mountains after all, Michael chided her in his Australian accent, making the comment feel rougher than he probably intended. The trail was hard-packed, dense with peat, void of grass. Rock and boulders decorated a landscape requiring a random boulder scramble that had kept things interesting. It wound back and forth in a lazy switchback. After a couple of hours, they topped out on a false summit. The Trekkers were energetic. They led the hike. Without fanfare, a string of prayer flags appeared, always in the same order from left to right. Blue, white, red, green, yellow. Blue represented the sky. White represented the air. Red symbolized fire, green for water, and finally, yellow symbolized the earth. All five colors together signified balance. As they crested another rocky outcropping, the summit appeared. It was covered with prayer flags, spreading goodwill and positive energy on the winds. More than 50 people stood on the broad summit, all with huge smiles, cameras clicking, and sharing generous hugs. It was a clear day, so the view of Everest was stunning. Me and Everest. Paul, one of the Trekkers, declared. Tony took his picture, stepping back to capture the view in his huge smile. Harper scrambled over to give him a huge hug. Congratulations, she said, as he began to tear up. As they stood on the summit, the prayer flags fluttered so hard in the wind that they looked as though they might fly away. Harper moved to lean against the rock to steady herself against the winds. She wanted a good look to take it all in, though. Her survey revealed Everest. She could clearly see the south summit, Nuptse, a bit of Lhotse, and the Khumbu Icefall was in direct view, as was Everest Base Camp. As Harper looked back down valley, Amina Blom stood proud. Her head dropped as she pondered what she was seeing, what she was attempting. She thought of Mark, her husband, and her kids. Now Harper looked at Everest as a climber, not as a trekker. Then for a moment, the winds calmed. John Paul spoke to no one in particular. I've been making this trip for 10 years now, and it never gets old, and it's always a thrill. The view of Mount Everest does not get any better from this side. No wind for now and clear skies. It can't be beaten. Looking up at the summit and thinking of all the times and all the efforts I spent on that beast brings back so much emotion that it's hard to put into words. But I can promise you this, the connection you make after you summit with Everest is a bond that'll last forever. I take pride in sharing what I've learned, what I've experienced. Mountains are harsh, unforgiving of mistakes, but also rewarding. Every trip I return home, a better version of myself. As the team returned to Gorg Shep, Dawa announced, good news, the Icefall doctors have the route into camp too, in through the Western Khum. Chapter 15, April 18th, honoring the fallen. The 2,000 foot Khumbu Icefall is known as a dangerous place. Giant ice blocks can move up to 3 feet a day. massive seracs hanging off the walls of Everest's west shoulder, and Nuzzi could release at any time, falling onto the icefall. If there are people there, there's little chance of surviving. On April 19th, 2014, this exact scenario occurred, taking the life of 16 Sherpas. For some guides, they choose not to guide on the Nepal side and only on the Tibetan side because of this danger. Dawa and John Paul walked into the dining room at Everest Base Camp. The entire team plus the trekkers were there. On Friday, April 18th, 2014, 6 years ago at 6:30 a.m., part of the ice serac that's on the west shoulder of Everest released. There were Sherpas in the icefall. The ladder had collapsed and the icefall doctors were headed there to replace it. The Sherpas ferrying gear to Camp 2 chose to stay there, most not wanting to return to base camp. However, with no warning, a deluge of car and house-sized ice blocks fell directly on top of them. Dawa paused, remembering his brother, who was there that day. John Paul picked it up. 16 Sherpas lost their lives that Friday. Now, each year on April 18th, all activities pauses to honor our family and friends. While everyone seems stoic and focused on their jobs, there will be tears just below the surface. Harper lifted her head and glanced around the table. The team was silent, taking in what they just heard. "I'm so sorry, Dawa, about your brother," Harper said softly. He nodded without looking up. Just as Harper felt at the climbing Sherpa Memorial a couple of days ago, she struggled with a range of highly mixed emotions. Is it fair to ask the climbing Sherpas to do the work they do? Are they paid enough to compensate for the risk? Who takes care of their families when an incident occurs? Should anyone be climbing these dangerous peaks anyway? The questions were not new. They've been asked since the days of Mallory and Irvine, and many of the answers remain unchanged today. Did anything change after 2014 for the climbing Sherpas? Michael asked. Dawa tried to explain the complexities of the Nepali government, politics, ethnic issues, and jealousy. He said the families of the 2014 tragedy received about $5,000 from the Nepal government. It's a considerable sum of money in this impoverished nation. Still, it created ill will towards the climbing Sherpas from the other ethnicities throughout Nepal. However, the life insurance was increased after that incident to $16,400. The climbing Sherpas ended the 2014 a few days after the tragedy. They created a list of demands for improved working conditions for the government, but almost none were approved. Dawa continued, "You see, the real problem is the Nepal government is always in transition. We have a new minister of tourism every couple of years, and that person does not honor the rules put in by the one before. So they start all over. Also, climbing Sherpas are viewed as rich people. We are Buddhist and most government officials are Hindu. So that's another difference making understanding difficult. The loss of life in 2014 was unparalleled and reached deep into their culture. The elder Sherpas were devastated by the loss of life and everyone knew someone who died in the Sherpa community. Then the earthquake occurred in 2015, only a year later. That took another 11 lives of Sherpas. They were all at base camp when the avalanche hit." Dawa added, "Yes, we climbing Sherpas have a choice. We can choose not to climb, but there's not many options for us who want to live here in the Khumbu and other valleys to make a living." Jim was in deep thought as he listened to Dawa. He'd been on Everest last year and drew on his experience. "You know, that serac is still up there. It's been there for decades, if not centuries. I understand there's a huge piece hanging on by a thread. All the autumn expeditions last year got scared off. They left. But has it fallen? Should we not risk going through the icefall this year?" He was correct. He knew how slow he was last year, and this year he felt even slower. He struggled to get up Kalapatar. But they were there, and he was committed. It felt too late and too early to give up now. "We'll be going earlier than usual, leaving Everest Base Camp at 2 a.m. when everything is frozen. We'll try to go fast. There'll be few breaks. We've got to be efficient," John Paul lectured his climbers. "Also this year, we'll use helicopters to ferry ropes and anchors for the fixed line to Camp 2 to the summit instead of having the climbing Sherpas carry them. That'll reduce their exposure by hundreds of loads." Dawa nodded knowingly. "Okay, tomorrow we'll do some refresher training here at Base Camp. You know, crampon techniques, climbing steep snow walls, crossing ladders. Come to breakfast ready," John Paul announced. The couple held hands tightly as they went back to their tent. Michael and Jim felt stiff, tired, like they shouldn't be there. Tony had made a friend in Dutch walk back to the tent area. "Man, that was tough to hear," Dutch said. "I can't believe Dawa lost his brother." Harper crawled into her tent. One by one, she looked at pictures of Mark and her kids that she had put on the storage wall in her tent. She stared at them for a long time. The photo of her family on the beach, all four of them, laughing, everyone so happy. Harper remembered the time like it was today. She took out the satellite phone out of her duffel, and she pressed the number one button. It's preset with Mark's telephone number. "Honey, I miss you." Chapter 16, Settling into Base Camp. The Mount Everest guys team of climbers and trekkers and a few climbing Sherpas left Gorik Shep for the 2-hour walk to Everest Base Camp. The trail followed the Khumbu Glacier as it trickled down from the icefall in the Western Khumbu. The rocky lateral moraines, their sides pushed up by centuries of flowing ice, towered for a few hundred feet in places. They were all dirt-covered ice. It was hard to realize the ice was still moving. Navigating between the many yak trains ferrying gear to Everest Base Camp and hundreds of other climbers and trekkers, the scene felt chaotic, busy, not serene and straightforward as some of the previous days. Harper felt her anxiety increase as the frenetic pace followed suit. "Okay, everybody, listen up. It's pretty crowded today. There'll be several large trekking teams on day trips going to base camp. So let's slow down. Let's take our time. And let's not let this get to us," John Paul told the group during a break. "We lived up at 17,500 feet, so tonight's going to be a tough night. The highest sleep thus far. So remember, hydrate, hydrate, hydrate." Her last few steps into Everest Base Camp brought out a mixture of feelings. "Welcome!" Harper was surprised to have a personal greeting. It was Dawa. He had gone ahead to make sure camp was ready for their charges. "Please let me introduce you to Mingma. He'll be your personal climbing Sherpa." This moment was the first of many times Harper would look into Mingma's bright eyes and see his contagious smile. There was a confidence that she immediately recognized. No, that she immediately felt. He took her hand in a firm handshake and repeated, "I am Mingma. I'll be your personal climbing Sherpa." Dawa continued introductions. "Mingma has summited Everest 17 times, and he's been over 50 expeditions all around the world, not just Everest. He was on K2 in 2014. He's one of the most experienced climbing Sherpas on Everest." Mingma just stood there tall, smiled. He asked if this is the first time to Everest. "Yes, I hope I'll do well. I've trained hard. I've been on many other climbs," Harper offered his resume, her resume to Mingma. Mingma continued to smile and nodded. "You'll do fine. We go Bastari, Bastari, slowly, slowly." Harper asked about his family. He lived in Pingboche with his wife. He had two children, both girls in boarding school in Kathmandu. "Maybe I'll have a son one day, but I don't want him to be a guide. Maybe move to America or Australia and go to college." In one sentence, Harper felt a connection, a bond. "I have two girls, also both in school." Mingma smiled broadly. Everest Base Camp was huge, and Harper saw just a small part. It had snowed last night, so a dense fog and a white blanket covered most of the camp. As she looked around, 9 more climbing Sherpas stood almost in a line, similar to a military review. Each offered their hand and said their name. "Welcome to Base Camp. I'm Nima. I'm Dawa. I'm Pisang. I am..." One by one, everybody introduced themselves, each with a warm smile. Harper passed one tent filled with more of these unsung heroes of Everest, the cook staff. They crowded around the door, curious to get a look at their first impressions of their members. She took their picture, much to their delight. "Namaste," she offered with respect. Harper found herself standing in front of a large yellow tent where they would eat their meals. Breakfast at 8, lunch at noon, dinner at 6. It was also the town hall, the meeting place, the general hangout. Mingma showed her to her tent, a 3-person yellow tent only for her. Each person had their own personal tent at base camp. They would share tents higher up on the mountain. Her tent was number 3 in a row of 10. Harper memorized the location, knowing that she would make quick midnight runs to the toilet. Both of her duffels already sat by her tent. How did they know? As Mingma left her to get settled in her tent, her mind raced. Her emotions ran the gamut. Her heart raced and her breathing picked up. Was it the altitude? Or maybe she was just realizing where she was. She crawled into the yellow tent. There was a small mattress already there, but she pressed on with her decision that to bring her thick X-Ped air mattress. Yeah, that was wise. Her mattress was much thicker than the one provided. Harper sat cross-legged, her head slightly brushing the roof of the tent, her boots neatly placed outside. A light breeze caused the tent door to gently wave as a bright sun warmed the tent. She took off her down jacket. A cacophony of sounds took her attention, conversations in Nepali, German, Italian, English, and Sherpani. The energy level was high. The excitement, determination, the purpose came through in their tone. Harper heard the hissing sounds of stoves working hard to boil the water. The camp was alive. Harper returned to her task. Slowly, she undipped her base cap and duffel bag and began to pull out each critical item one by one. She had taken hours to pack and knew where each item was, which stuff sack, the color of each. First was her sleeping bag. Then the minus 20 sleeping bag. Her camp booties, toothbrush, and other essential items that she would use each day, each night, and grab quickly, including her headlamp, a dedicated one just for her tent. Harper took out her small, fluffy pillow. It was one of the non-negotiable pieces of, quote, gear Harper always brought on long expeditions. She had learned over the years that success on the mountain begins with a good night's sleep, and a pillow is a must for her. A simple pillow was unabashed luxury at base camp compared to the high camps where a down jacket stuffed in a soft cotton pillowcase would suffice. As Harper pulled her pillow out of her duffel, the scent of laundry detergent filled the tent confines. Harper pulled it close, pushing against her face deeply with intention. She drew a deep breath of the smell now rubbed off. Now she smelled like home. For a moment, she was transported to a world half a world away. And she saw the most important faces to her in her life. She saw their faces, heard their laughter, felt their love. Harper smiled. She took out her small picture album, preferring to have printed pictures so she could hold them rather than electronic ones on her phone. With a jolt, Harper was brought back to present, her attention shifting to the sound of footsteps, big footsteps, and a bell. She leaned forward for a look-see. She made eye contact with her visitor. He was 600 pounds covered in fur, but he had gentle eyes. He could have been a she. It was hard to tell. The bell, a yak bell around his, her neck, clanged with the resonance of a well-designed church bell. His job completed, his load delivered to base camp. He was just meandering around camp, loose from his tether, searching for a bit of lunch. He moved on. Harper did a controlled fall backwards into her tent, reestablishing her sitting position. She took a deep breath. That surprised her. She felt winded even from a simple move in tent. Oh, life at 17,500 feet was revealing itself in small ways. Harper moved over her sleeping bag. Lying down, her head on her pillow, she closed her eyes. The breeze encouraged the prayer flags to spread their goodwill. The sounds were a confirmation that she was in Everest Base Camp. In her tent, that would be her sanctuary, her refuge for the next month. Her mind drifted as she sunk into the down. The sounds blended, encouraging her trance. She felt at peace. She had completed the first leg of her long journey, and now the time was to begin the next leg. Hey, how's your tent? It was Dutch in the tent right to her, next to her. What's that sound? Harper poked her head out of the tent, looked left. It was Snore, a.k.a. Michael.